tonight on All In.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she fears for our very democracy if Republicans win in November. Do you?
The fate of democracy and the Republican Party in the wake of Liz Cheney's loss.
I think we have to make sure that we are fighting against every single election denier. The election deniers right now are Republicans.
Then, what did Rudy Giuliani tell a Fulton County grand jury?
Do you believe President Trump is the ultimate target of this investigation?
And are we on the verge of seeing a roadmap to the government's ongoing investigation of Donald Trump? Plus, raw politics at the greengrocer in Pennsylvania.
For those watching in Pennsylvania, you know how particular many people are about their groceries. What happened with Wegmans and Wegners? Can you explain that to them?
And a Republican reckoning with extreme abortion laws that needs to be seen to be believed.
That weighs on me. I voted for that bill. These are affecting people.
When All In starts right now. Good evening from New York. I'm Chris Hayes. We now have, of course, the results from the Republican primary for Wyoming's lone at-large congressional seat. Congresswoman Liz Cheney, vice chair of the January 6th committee, was, well, annihilated, as we expected. She lost by a resounding 37 points, 28.9% to 66.3%. Wyoming voters overwhelmingly rebuked Cheney, who, of course, stood up to Donald Trump after his insurrection, voting to impeach him and then helping to lead the committee investigating his actions. Now, Liz Cheney has earned a lot of praise, especially in liberal circles, for taking a stand against Trump and his attempt to end America's constitutional republic. Fellow January 6th committee member, Congressman Jamie Raskin, has spoken incredibly fondly about her, recently telling the New Republic that she has acted with great honesty to confront the lies of the Trump machinery. Raskin also said about his unlikely friend, quote, "She will follow Donald Trump to the gates of hell if she needs to make sure that justice is done and that truth is known." And there's no doubt Liz Cheney has made genuine career political sacrifices on behalf of American democracy. That was evident last night, almost as soon as polls closed. And what she has done is praiseworthy and important. But it's also the case that, you know, Cheney's a bone-deep reactionary, a conservative to her core, and also, crucially, a partisan Republican. None of that's changed. And as strange as it may seem, she has, I think, taken this course of action in an attempt to save the Republican Party. This morning on the Today Show, Liz Cheney laid out her case.
Look, I think the Republican Party today is in very bad shape. And I think that we have a tremendous amount of work to do. I think it could take several election cycles. But the country has got to have a Republican Party that's actually based on substance, based on principles, you know, based on a belief in limited government and low taxes and a strong national defense, a belief that the family has got to be the center of our community and of our lives. And those are the principles I believe in. That's what the party used to stand for. And we've got to get the party back to that.
Now, I will leave aside my own significant quibbles with the definition of what the party used to stand for. You'll notice, just to make one observation, she omitted the torture program, the war crimes that were championed by her father and endorsed by her from that list. But the key point here is that in her own understanding, Congresswoman Cheney is standing up to Donald Trump, not just for the sake of American democracy, but for the sake of the institutional vitality and indeed survival of the Republican Party itself. And I think she is right on this. And I think it's underappreciated how right she is by everyone. Because here's the thing. A conservative party in a two-party liberal democracy like ours, which is what the Republican Party is and has been, cannot continue to thrive or even exist if the MAGA authoritarian cult takes over. There is no space for that institution in the world in which Donald Trump is successful, in which he successfully overturns American democracy. Which is to say, to save the Republican Party, you actually must save American democracy. And somehow, Liz Cheney seems to be one of the only members of her party to grasp this elemental truth, or at least one of the only ones to act on it. The other Republican cowards cannot muster the same courage to do what she has done to save their own hides in the end. Instead, they have dealt with this tension between the need to, again, preserve American democracy and their desire to win elections, retain their jobs, by basically going along with whatever Donald Trump says, winking and nodding and evading sometimes, pretending they didn't hear it. And that's basically the consensus view. That appears to be the calculation that everyone from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis to Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has made. Now, the Republican who's been the most forthright about his thinking on this, actually, is Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. Graham, of course, not always a fan of Donald Trump. In fact, he has made a real U-turn since that 2016 campaign.
Here's what I think. I think Donald Trump is a political car wreck. He's a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot. He's a jack. Donald Trump is not strong. He's actually weak. He's a bully. He's a cartoon character. Donald Trump is the most unelectable Republican I've seen in my lifetime.
He shouldn't be commander-in-chief.
He's destroying the party. There'd be a generation before we can overcome this. Maybe never.
You know how you make America great again? Tell Donald Trump to go to hell.
Now, Graham, I suppose to his credit, has been very honest about why he has come around on Donald Trump. This is what he said at a right-wing pro-Trump summit just last month.
If you think Trump is bad for the party, I disagree with you. I think President Trump is good for the party. Let me tell you why. President Trump has gotten people who wouldn't give me or Romney or anybody else the time of day. They believe that he is on their side. I'm trying to move toward a strong America, and he's the vehicle to get us there.
Now, this is really interesting because actually, if you look at the earlier clips of Lindsey Graham and the latter ones, he's making the same argument. It's just about what Donald Trump does for the Republican Party, right? At first, he thought he was bad for the Republican Party. Now he's become convinced he's good. And the argument is basically, what are you going to do? The base loves him. And in the short term, to win elections for the Republican Party, Lindsey Graham is correct. The math just does not work for Republicans in this election or the one 2 years after to achieve reliable broad victories without Donald Trump and his supporters. Doesn't work. But Graham and everyone who toes that line, right? They don't seem to have thought through what happens next. So you win some elections. Maybe you get power. What happens if Trump and his people win? These are people who are, by their own words, right, fundamentally opposed to the American system. What happens if you have people who think that Hugo Chavez's ghost hacked voting machines and that the Chinese snuck in bamboo paper to steal an election? What happens when you have them running our elections? We're close to that. We're on the precipice of that. Under the Lindsey Graham strategy, that's what is going to happen if he's right. People come out and vote for them. What happens when that succeeds, when Trump succeeds? What happens when Trump succeeds where January 6th barely failed? I'll tell you what happens. And I think Liz Cheney would agree with me. The Republican Party, the thing we know as that, will not be preserved. If Donald Trump succeeds in his project of destroying American democracy, it will succeed in creating something entirely new, something very ugly, and let me tell you, incredibly unpredictable. And it will not be a world, I would be willing to bet, in which people like Lindsey Graham or Mitch McConnell or a lot of the rest of them thrive. Liz Cheney seems to be just about the only person in the party who recognizes this at a cellular level. Keep in mind, she is not a liberal in any way. She is a solid right winger. She was number three in House leadership. She voted in line with Donald Trump even more than Lindsey Graham did. She was with Trump just about every step of the way, even while he was essentially kidnapping children. She was with him until he tried to topple America's constitutional republic. Watching him attempt to assassinate American democracy made Liz Cheney realize that you cannot keep the tiger on the leash because he will eat you. She realized there is no future with Donald Trump, even for her most selfish political institutional interest, the Republican Party, to which she is an heir. What would there be left to rule except a kingdom of ashes if Trump is successful in his project? And if enough of her colleagues have realized it too, if they had the fortitude and courage Liz Cheney has, they might have been able to do something about it. They had a moment, if they had collectively struck when they had the opportunity during the second impeachment trial, If they had voted to convict, bar him from future office, I don't think we'd be in this situation. But they were cowards. They were all cowards. And so Liz Cheney is alone. And we are going to see, all of us, how the Lindsey Graham strategy plays out. Tim Miller is a writer at large for The Bulwark and a former RNC spokesman. Mona Charon is the policy editor for The Bulwark and a former speechwriter for Nancy Reagan. And they both joined me now. First, let me just start with your response to that thesis, that it is in the institutional interest of the Republican Party, as a conservative party in a democracy, for democracy to continue, and that Liz Cheney understands this and at some level is doing something that she thinks adheres to the benefit of what we come to think of the Republican Party. Mona.
I have a slightly different perception of Liz Cheney from you. I think that she is being far less concerned about Republicans and the fate of the Republican Party. And she's really all about the fate of the country, recognizing that Donald Trump's ascendance is a threat to our very democratic system. And therefore, she has really shed a lot of her partisan concerns. I mean, you can hear it in the interviews that you know, you said she hasn't become any less partisan. I don't agree. If you listen to her, she's really just about unity now.
I think that's fair. I think she has become part of the popular front in defense of America's constitutional governance, basically.
Yes.
Abroad, which is broad, as I like to joke, it goes from Noam Chomsky to Bill Kristol. It's a big tent. She is in that, right?
Right.
But I also do think that, I guess the point that I think she grasps that others don't, Tim, is like, I don't think Graham and the rest can conceptualize Trump's success. This is what I think it is. I don't think they think he's capable of pulling it off. And so I think they will still be in the driver's seat, that Mitch McConnell will get power back and he'll sort of run the show and they'll get their judges. And no one's thought through, like, what does it actually look like if they really pull it off, right? Like, if the whole American experiment collapses in on itself, what's life like for Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham? I think it doesn't look as good as I think they might understand.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that that is what's so refreshing about Liz Cheney is that her view of Donald Trump is really not all that different from Mitch McConnell's view of Donald Trump, right? They
Correct.
Both think he's
yes,
dangerous.
Agreed.
They both think that he's buffoonish. You know, they both wish he would just disappear. But what Liz Cheney does is then act on that as if that's a very serious thing that needs to be acted upon, right? And that has been the refreshing thing about her and the frustrating thing for all of us, you know, over the past 6 years, who know that our former colleagues and our former friends see him in the same way that we see him, but aren't acting on it, right? And that, I think, relates directly to this threat assessment, right? Like, she saw January 6th in the same way that we all did as a potentially an existential threat to the country. She sees all these MAGA Secretary of States and gubernatorial candidates that are coming up as an existential threat to the country. And I think that whether Lindsey Graham has convinced himself that he can nudge Donald Trump the right direction, or whether that he thinks that this is all too buffoonish and silly to actually come down, or whether he lives in this kind of privilege bubble, you know, that makes him feel like the American system will never be toppled and that's not something to worry
right.
about, or some combination of all those things, they just are not acting on the reality that we all see, and she is.
But Chris, if you as a Republican can look at Donald Trump and say, yes, he represents a threat to our way of life. Yes, he represents a threat to this democratic experiment. But I'm going to go ahead and support him anyway because my reelection is at issue. Then you really don't care. If you really understand that
right.
and you know what's at stake, then you really don't care about the country in the end. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, and there's also, Mona, I mean, there's a kind of tactical question, too, which is so frustrating, I think, in retrospect, when you look at the 10 Republicans that voted for impeachment, for instance, among whom Liz Cheney is one of them. Basically, there's only two remaining candidates for reelection. The others have bowed out, like Cheney had been defeated by Trump-backed challengers, right? Like, they have been picked off one by one. But there was a moment after right. January 6th, I remember sitting, you know, in front of this camera, when news broke that Mitch McConnell was leaking, he didn't know how he was going to vote on impeachment, right? If people had moved, the collective action people, if people moved as a group,
absolutely,
it might be different, right? But they all, they ended up going out there and then turning around and there was no one behind them.
You know, and it's funny because, you know, there are these sayings on the Hill, you know, when they have like a tough vote where they say, well, if we all hold hands together, then we can do it. Right. Where if like across the aisle, you know, we'll take some heat from our side. You'll take. And so but they never applied that principle within the Republican Party dealing with Trump. If they had just all held hands, they could have done it on two occasions. So they didn't.
And they have it now, Tim, which means that they've got the tiger problem. I mean, this is really it, right? And it's not a thing, and I think you all three of us agree on this, it's not a thing that could be ignored or compromised or massaged or synthesized. It's a dividing line that can't be bridged. And you know, Cheney and Kinzinger and you two and others are, you know, call that, but very few others will.
You know, look, we're beating the metaphor to death, but the tiger owns them now, right? I mean, they're totally at the mercy of the tiger. They have no control over this. They might have for a moment, right? But now they've completely even given up pretending as if that they do. And I think that the thing that is so frustrating when I listen to your intro, Chris, is not only was it the right thing for morally and for the country for them to all hold hands and jump together during the second impeachment, but it was the right thing for the party. In the medium term, right? They could have very easily just moved on to Ron DeSantis, right? There would have been 3% of the party would have been Donald Trump dead enders, like the, you know, last Japanese on the still fighting the war. But most of the party would have gladly moved on to Ron DeSantis. The Trump problem would have been done. A couple of them would have been sacrificed in the primary. We would have needed a few more Liz Cheney's. That's it. And that is the only thing that separates her from them is that she had the courage to say, I will sacrifice myself on the pyre. And so she has.
Yeah, that's my point. That is my thesis here, is that all the other things aside, I don't think the people that run the Republican Party have correctly adduced their own self-interest in a more medium term than just the next election. And I think, you know, everyone's going to pay for it in the end, hopefully not in the worst case scenario. Tim Miller and Mona Sharon, thank you both.
Thanks.
Coming up, the incredible scene outside a Fulton County courthouse today, down in the state of Georgia. Donald Trump's former lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, testifies before a Georgia grand jury. What did Rudy say, and what does it mean for his old boss? Next.
There's overwhelming proof of fraud. It depends on you, and it depends on your determination of credibility. I don't have to be a genius to figure out that those votes are not legitimate votes. You don't put legitimate votes under a table.
No.
Wait until you throw the opposition out and in the middle of the night count them. We would have to be fools to think that. So no need to push it any further, but there's more than ample evidence to conclude that this election was a sham. In my view, it was part of a concerted plan. Because certain cities were picked in order to carry this out where they thought they could get away with it.
It was Trump lawyer, coup plotter Rudy Giuliani in Georgia back in 2020, with baseless lies and accusations, pretty close to slander, actually, that the president election was rigged. Well, today, he returned to the state to testify in the ongoing Fulton County criminal investigation into alleged interference in the 2020 election, an investigation that we have since learned he is formally a target of. As you can see, Giuliani was initially locked out of the courthouse, had to wait for a security guard to let him into the building with all the press around him assembled. When asked, Giuliani was noncommittal as to whether or not he would cooperate with the investigation.
What are you expecting to talk about here today?
Well, they ask the questions and we'll see.
Will you be cooperative? I mean, your attorney in New York says he can't promise how responsive
you'll be. I'm the attorney.
Goodbye.
And while he had much to say about Georgia after the election, it's unclear exactly what he said today in his more than 6 hours before the grand jury. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, quote, Giuliani's attorneys would not say whether he pleaded the Fifth Amendment to avoid self-incrimination. Rebecca Roifey is a former Manhattan assistant district attorney. She's now a law professor at New York Law School, and she joins me now. Rebecca, first I want to just talk about the situation Giuliani finds himself in which he has been informed he is a target in the investigation, and also subpoenaed for testimony. again, 1 + 1 sort of seems like it adds up to 2 if you're advising him legally. Like, how common is this kind of thing where a grand jury is a subpoena for someone that has also been informed by the prosecutor's office they're a target?
You know, it happens, and different states do it differently, but, you know, it certainly happens most of the time under these circumstances. You know, any individual in their right mind would plead the Fifth, because obviously the investigators have told, the DA has told Rudy Giuliani that they have substantial evidence at this point to link him to criminal activity and that an indictment is possible. And under those conditions, it's hard to imagine why he would be forthcoming. Now, he had said previously that he was going to invoke the attorney-client privilege, but that would have only covered part of his testimony here because it only covers communications with a client,
right,
confidential communications for the purpose of obtaining legal advice. There's a lot of other information that they're looking for that that doesn't even come close to. So the question is, does he plead the Fifth or not? And, you know, it would be unusual, to say the least, if he was forthcoming under these circumstances.
You know, I've spoken about this case a number of times, and it stuck with me one time when we were talking about this case, and I was talking about that presidential phone call, particularly Trump's phone call with Raffensperger, and I said, you know, this just seems criminal on its face. And you said, look, you know, there's intent here. It's not a slam dunk case by any means. What is your assessment of the legal threat right now? Not to Trump, who obviously is not been identified as a target, but the people like Giuliani who do seem like they're in the crosshairs.
You know, I think since then, there has been a lot of information that may have changed my position somewhat. And most of that comes from the number of times from top advisors he's been told that he lost that election. And so the notion that he honestly believed at this moment that the election was stolen, I thought when I last came on and said that, that that was plausible. And I think it's an increasingly less plausible defense here. Now, in terms of Rudy Giuliani, and whether he thought that, again, it's hard to imagine, especially given the fact that, you know, we've heard reporting that he said, you know, I don't even know whether there's evidence. It just, you know, seems like there has to be or something like that. So clearly, you know, that doesn't seem like a likely defense for him either. And he's a lawyer, you know, so at a certain point for a lawyer, you say, look, you're charged with understanding the difference between fact and fantasy. And if your defense is you bought into a fantasy, that's a lame defense.
I want to ask a question about another local prosecutor's case with another Trump-related case, which is your old office in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, which has brought criminal charges against Alan Weisselberg, who's a CFO for the Trump Org, and criminal charges against the Trump Org itself. We've got word today that Weisselberg will plead guilty apparently tomorrow to a number of felonies and will not cooperate against Trump personally, but reporting indicating that he will cooperate in a criminal trial of the Trump Organization. What do you make of that?
You know, that's big news because it makes it such that it's hard to imagine what defense the organization has, because an organization obviously has no separate existence other than through its employees. And so, you know, if a high managerial agent, someone in a position of power like Weisselberg, is committing crimes and says that he was committing crimes on behalf of the organization, that strips the organization of, I think, almost any defense in this case, which then leads to, you know, a very likely criminal conviction. And that's a big deal, because that, you know, we used to say in the office, that's a death sentence for an organization or a corporation. A criminal conviction makes it such that it's very highly unlikely that the organization can continue. Now, I know that Trump Org is complex, and this does not involve every piece of Trump Organization.
Right.
So with that caveat, you know, I do think it's significant for Trump and his business and the future of his business in New York.
All right. Rebecca Roifey, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Still ahead, the Justice Department has been tight-lipped about why they searched Donald Trump's retirement home. But tomorrow, a judge could reveal a lot more. Former FBI Special Agent Asha Rangappa breaks down what to expect next. Before the FBI could get a search warrant to go through Donald Trump's Florida residence last week, agents presented a judge with an affidavit. This is standard operating procedure, in which, presumably, they made the case of why the ex-president's home needed to be searched, what the FBI expected to find there, and how agents obtained their information. They presented all that to a judge, who then issued the warrant, as we know. Last week, that search warrant was unsealed. It gave us an idea of what was recovered at Mar-a-Lago. The affidavit, however, remains under seal. That's why there's a hearing set for tomorrow at 1 p.m. A judge will decide if that document should be released or not. The Department of Justice is fighting the release, warning that, quote, if disclosed, the affidavit would serve as a roadmap to the government's ongoing investigation in a matter that is highly likely to compromise future investigative steps. The fact that this investigation implicates highly classified materials further underscores the need to protect the integrity of the investigation. Asha Rangappa is a former FBI special agent focused on counterintelligence investigations. She's an attorney and senior lecturer at Yale University, and she joins me now. George Conway was on the program last night, Asha, and he said, look, there's no chance this judge is going to unseal this. That seems to be the consensus. Is that where you are?
Yes, that's where I am. And I think that the government, I think that's typical in a case. The time for the government to show Trump the money, I guess it were, would be at trial, right? If they choose to bring charges, that's where they have to reveal their witnesses, let Trump confront them, give him all access to the evidence that's going to be used against him. But what is happening right now is that the investigation is ongoing. They are still building the case. And there's a few clues in this government filing. As you mentioned, first, they mentioned the roadmap, the fact that this would disclose the direction and scope of the investigation, investigative steps, witnesses. And Chris, this tells me that this probable cause was based on a number of factors, not just one source. They have a lot of different pieces of information, which would be expected if they were asking a judge to approve a search in this case. The second compelling reason is that they say revealing these witnesses or sources could put them in danger. And there's a footnote here that actually cites to the attack on the FBI Cincinnati's office. So this is a way in which Trump and his supporters' rhetoric is actually working against them in this legal argument. And then finally, as you mentioned, they say that this implicates highly classified information. So there's a national security interest here. And I think this is definitely what tips the balance in the government's favor, because there's a lot of deference given when the government is trying to protect national security, and a compromising of an investigation that is trying to protect national security would be harmful to the entire nation.
Let me ask you about the Department of Justice more broadly and Merrick Garland. I mean, you and I, again, we've spoken a number of times. I think you've been in the camp of a little bit in the camp of like, what exactly is going on over there? Are you guys watching this January 6th hearing? Are you moving along on this? It does seem like there's sufficient, you know, predicate for an investigation, all that. You know, in the intervening weeks, we've now got lots of activity at that grand jury, January 6th grand jury in D.C. We've got this search of the Mar-a-Lago home. Have you changed your perspective on what your understanding of where DOJ and Merrick Garland are on this?
So, Chris, I'm not sure if you're asking about where they are on this in terms of the Mar-a-Lago investigation or January 6th, because I think they're a little bit different. I continue to believe that Merrick Garland is very Hamlet-like. Like, I think he thinks about this and struggles with it. And you mm-hmm. know, I think he understands that this is a historical moment. I think that the normal considerations that we've talked about before with the January 6th investigation pursuing Trump, he had to put those aside in many ways because this involved, again, national security concerns. In other words, he had no choice but to recover these documents because they are so sensitive and because doing so could seriously injure the United States or help one of our adversaries. So I think in many ways he was forced to take this step. That's why I think it is still an open question whether he is going to actually pursue charges, because when you have a national security interest, there's competing goals here. National security interests are a little bit different than the criminal punishment, deterrence, all of that kind of stuff. They've recovered the documents. So there's a possibility that he could say, look, goal achieved, mischief managed. You know, we now have these, we can assess the damage, we can move on, focus on these other investigations. I think the filing, to go back to the affidavit, their argument is that it's inappropriate to unseal an affidavit before charges are filed and that this is an ongoing investigation, which again suggests to me that they believe that the fair part, the part where Trump's interests will be vindicated and his rights, et cetera, will be when
charges are filed. So I think it might be moving in that direction in this case, mainly because I think it would look really bad if he didn't, if he wasn't ready to go all the way. I still am not completely sure about the January 6th investigation, partly because some of those criminal charges are trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. So I think it really depends on the evidence that they accumulate, among other factors.
Speaking of that evidence, we should note the New York Times just reporting right before we went on air that federal prosecutors have issued a grand jury subpoena to the National Archives for all the documents the agency provided to the January 6th committee. That seems to be playing a little bit of catch up, but obviously that's also a huge cache of documents. So that, you know, we are learning about things. I think this actually subpoena was issued back in May. So we're learning about things a bit latently in terms of what that grand jury has been up to. But it has been quite active as well. Asha Rangappa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, why is Dr. Oz having so much trouble connecting in his very recently adopted home state of Pennsylvania? It might have something to do with his grocery shopping habits. That's next. The Pennsylvania Senate race, Democrat John Fetterman, Lieutenant Governor of that state, has demonstrated from the get-go a very clear vision of how to run against his Republican opponent, millionaire TV doctor Mehmet Oz. Paint him as a rich, out-of-touch buffoon who does not live in, nor understand, the state he is ostensibly running to represent. Back in April, Oz released a video, sort of standard stuff, attacking Democrats for high prices at the grocery store, and it has resurfaced this week.
I thought I'd do some grocery shopping. I'm at Wegner's, and my wife wants some vegetables for crudité, right? So here's a broccoli. That's $2. Not a ton of broccoli there. Here's some asparagus. That's $4. Yep. Carrots. That's $4 more. That's $10 of vegetables there. And then we need some guacamole. That's $4 more. And she loves salsa. Yeah, there's salsa there. $6. Must be a shortage of salsa. Guys, that's $20 for crudité. This doesn't include the tequila. I mean, that's outrageous. And we got Joe Biden to thank for this.
Oh, I've watched that like 40 times now, but it just keeps paying off. First, there's no store called Wegner's, which is what he says he's at. Oz probably meant to say Redner's, which is a Pennsylvania-based supermarket chain, but got it confused with Wegmans, which is a fancier grocery chain in Pennsylvania and throughout the Northeast, with many locations in New Jersey, where Oz, of course, actually lives. And so Redner's and Wegmans became Wegner's. Didn't end there. Oz was trying to make the point that inflation was causing higher bills at the supermarket. His choice of crudité, a French raw vegetable platter, was not the most relatable shopping experience. Oz showed a head of broccoli, a bunch of asparagus, and a very large bag of full-size carrots. You can get those little, you know, cocktail ones. But when he realized the grand total was not that expensive, you could almost see him kind of panic midway through and go for the pre-made guacamole and salsa to just get those numbers up. Fetterman has been having an absolute field day with the video since it resurfaced earlier this week.
In PA, we call this a veggie tray. And if this looks anything other than a veggie tray to you, then I am not your candidate. And I'm serious, Dr. Oz doesn't even know the name of the grocery store that he's in.
Fetterman campaign is also now selling these Wegner's stickers captioned "Let them eat crudité," which have contributed to a more than $500,000 fundraising haul for Fetterman's campaign since that video went viral. Even the conservative outlet, the very conservative outlet Newsmax, won't give Oz a pass for the gaffe.
Let's talk crudité, if we can. Is Dr. Oz relatable to the everyday hardworking American there in Pennsylvania?
I joke about a crudité, which is a way of speaking about how ridiculous it is that you can't even put vegetables on a plate. In the middle of a campaign, we'll do whatever we need to do to make sure the people of Pennsylvania respect what we're about.
And I mean to fixate on it, but I just for those watching in Pennsylvania, you know how particular many people are about their groceries. What happened with Wegmans and Wegner's? Can you explain that to them?
Yeah, I was exhausted. When you're campaigning 18 hours a day, I've gotten my kids' names wrong as well.
So there's now another Oz gaffe making the rounds. The TV doctor recently said he owns two homes.
How many houses do you own?
I own two houses, but one of them we're building on. The other ones I rent.
So Oz claims he legitimately owns two houses and rents the other properties, but investigation by the Daily Beast found that he actually owns, I make this up, not 10 houses. He rents some of them out to other tenants as a landlord, but he's not renting them from someone else. Anyone who's ever rented understands there's a big difference between renting from and renting to. Now, it is still early, but this all explains why polling currently has Oz down double digits. The gap will narrow. We should consider this in every single battleground race statewide, basically close to a dead heat until Election Day. That's my operating assumption. But if Democrats are going to pull off a miracle and keep or even expand their Senate majority, they are going to need lots of help from walking, talking caricatures like Dr. Oz. There's been an enormous backlash across the country in the wake of the Supreme Court overturning Roe versus Wade. We're seeing it in blue states and red states alike. Earlier this month in red Kansas, voters rejected a ballot measure that would have removed the right to an abortion from the state constitution. They were the first state to vote squarely on abortion in that kind of referendum after the court's decision. And yesterday in South Carolina, the Republican-led House Judiciary Committee met to consider a near total abortion ban with no exceptions for rape or incest, which is where a Republican South Carolina lawmaker gave this moving speech.
A 19-year-old girl appeared at the ER. She was 15 weeks pregnant. Her water broke. And the fetus was unviable. The standard of care was to advise her that they could extract or she could go home. The attorneys told the doctors that because of the fetal heartbeat, Bill, because that 15-week-old had a heartbeat, the doctors could not extract. There's a 50% chance, greater than 50% chance, that she's going to lose her uterus. There's a 10% chance that she will develop sepsis and herself die. That weighs on me. I voted for that bill. These are affecting people, and we're having a meeting about this. It took that whole week. I did not sleep. I followed up with the doctor a week later. She had heard nothing, did not know about the 19-year-old. Thank God I followed up 2 weeks later. She did return to the ER. They did extract the now non-beating fetus. What we do matters.
That committee voted 13-7 to advance the bill. Five Republicans, including the man you just watched, didn't vote. Shefali Luthra is a health reporter at the 19th, an independent news organization which is doing great reporting on this, where she covers the intersection of gender and healthcare, and she joins me now. Shefali, first, I wondered, because you're sort of in the weeds on this and reporting on this, and there's a lot of different stories to track, the sort of general view of what's been happening in these states, particularly Republican-controlled states that didn't have some automatic law that just, you know, flipped on after the Dobbs decision, what they've been doing in those states, which all seems to be moving mostly in one direction towards, you know, outlawing abortion.
This has been really complicated and very difficult for these states that were theoretically prepared to move forward and start passing abortion bans. We saw this in Indiana, right, where exactly what you described, this intense divide amongst not Democrats, but Republicans over whether to include rape and incest exceptions, really derailed for a while the bill that now has passed and will take effect soon. Republicans are really, really torn over this. In West Virginia, the House and Senate passed competing abortion bans, one with rape and incest exceptions and the other without, and they haven't been able to reconcile that. And it is, in fact, such an intense debate that it has prevented them from passing this ban that they were called back into session to make law. And I think what's really striking is that this has been such an essential issue for Republicans for a long time, right? They've been passing abortion bans since Roe was law of the land, right? And we heard so many governors and political leaders talk about calling a special session as soon as Roe was overturned to pass these new bans, new restrictions. And a lot of them haven't done that. There was supposed to be this wave of new laws that came about this summer. And right now, what's instead happening is that Republicans, too, are really grappling, in some cases for the first time, with the personal and pragmatic and also the political consequences of these kinds of laws.
That's a really interesting point. I mean, there's also, of course, the politics of this, I think, as they grapple with that. I mean, there's new polling today from the Marquette poll, which was polling the statewide Senate race in Wisconsin, but it also asked people about abortion. Obviously, that's a very closely divided state. And, you know, do you favor the SCOTUS decision to overturn Roe v. Wade? Are you on the side of the court here? Only 62% of Republicans favor it, 28% oppose. That's a huge number. Among independents, 2/3 oppose it. Among Democrats, 92. Overall, 60-33. We've seen, you know, numbers like that in state after state after Dobbs, which I got to imagine is part of what's entering the mix as these states are moving, in some cases, fitfully to criminalize abortion.
This backlash has the potential to be really potent, right? It's what Democrats are counting on to hold on to the Senate, right? You hear Senator Elizabeth Warren talk all the time about Wisconsin and Pennsylvania in particular as states where she really sees the backlash to the overturning of Roe v. Wade as a chance to pick up seats. We've heard this from the Democratic Senate campaign arm, right? They really hope that this is something that voters are going to react to. And the polling is often tricky, right? Because polling on abortion is always complicated, and it depends on how you frame the question. But I think you're absolutely right that there is a real chance that this sort of breaks something that had been holding the Republican Party together for a long time. That's really what we saw in Kansas.
There's also, of course, the human aspect of this, which is harder to report on, obviously, because all of this is shrouded in privacy, as it should be. But this latest story out of Louisiana, where a woman named Nancy Davis says her baby was diagnosed with a crania, which is a rare and fatal condition where the baby's skull fails to form in the womb. And according to health experts, babies with this condition only survive minutes to hours after birth. But because the mother's life is not in danger, she does not qualify for an abortion. She was denied one, and she now has to carry the baby to term or cross state lines to get an abortion. Again, these are just one of the stories that we're hearing, but we know with certainty there are others like this. What effect do you think these kind of individual stories are having on people's perception of this?
I think they're tremendous. I think for a long time, this has been seen as this really abstract issue, right? It's something that happened to someone else and not to your loved one or sister or spouse or child. And now people are reading these stories and they're seeing themselves, right? Because this could happen to anyone and they're horrified that have no exceptions for the death of the fetus. They're horrified by these laws that are so unclear that doctors can't provide healthcare they expect to be able to give.
Shefali Luthra, who's been following this closely at the 19th, which has been a great source for this that I've been depending on. Thank you very much for your reporting. That does it for All In. You can catch us every weeknight at 8 o'clock on MSNBC. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/allinwithchris.